Today's gospel is, despite that story I just shared, more like an almost estranged uncle who shows up at your door after many years. I've had this experience, or at least something similar to it. As he says hello, you pick up wisps of alcohol on his breath. You notice he's wearing clothing that hasn't seen the inside of a washing machine in some time. And your uncle says to you, "Can I stay with you?" He is family, so come on in, you say, with misgiving, but also hope. And in the days that follow, you realize that your uncle has come on a mission, not for himself, but for you. Through stories, homespun, you're not sure what's true, what's not, witty sayings and generous questions, he shares not only his own wisdom, but opens your own story to him and to yourself. This gospel shows up on our doorstep in an unattractive manner, but it is the gospel. It is Jesus. So, will we invite him in? Will we invite him in? The first verse says this: when the days drew near for him to be taken up, he set his face to go to Jerusalem. This text is from chapter 9 of Luke's gospel, and just about 60% of the gospel remains in front of us. But from this point on, Jesus' face is set. Jerusalem is the goal. It's the verse that Luke structures the rest of his account around. And there's this interesting line right at the beginning that says, when the days drew near for him to be taken up. And that's a direct play on our first reading. You see, in the Israelite worldview, in Israelite metaphysics, only Elijah had ascended directly into God's presence without tasting death. There is that mysterious story of Enoch in Genesis 3, and there is the story of Moses dying but nobody knowing where his burial place was, which was taken as evidence that he may have ascended as well. But the only unequivocal example is that of Elijah. And so to this day, those of you who know the practices of Passover know that a place is set for Elijah, with the hope that his presence in that setting will be a harbinger, a sign that the Messiah is about to come. And so Luke is hinting that though Jesus is heading for Jerusalem to die, that is not the ultimate reason for his going there. He's going in order to be taken up, to be more alive than he, certainly than his followers, can imagine. This orientation to life, capital L, is meant to inform our interpretation of Jesus' journey towards Jerusalem, which we know is towards the cross. But all of his interactions in these stories and Christ's interactions with us at this table this morning are meant to orient us to life through the cross. Christ is concerned with one thing: life. As Paul puts it, "For freedom Christ has set us free. Stand firm, therefore, and do not submit again to a yoke of slavery." Well, what is that freedom? What is this yoke of slavery? And what indeed is life? And that's the problem, isn't it? We all have conceptions of these things, conceptions formed by our experiences, our knowledge of the past, and by our own desires. And a lot of those things are good, and they're true, and they're beautiful, but woven in as well is a shallowness of thinking that is not aligned with God's conception for us, to be images of the divine nature, to be in our human bodies and souls, expressions of the divine life. The biblical vision recognizes then that we live in a mashed up reality. And the New Testament understands, as we read in our second reading, that adding laws to correct behavior or expounding philosophical principles to add to our knowledge, good as those things are about as effective in our transformation as trying to return spilled milk to the carton free of all dirt once it hits the floor. It's not possible. And so Jesus and the writers who begin to interpret him in the New Testament understand that the key to human beings, the key to you and I here this morning, is our desires. It is our desires that are led astray into the works of the flesh that Paul mentions in our second reading, by which he means not that the flesh of our body is bad, but the ways of our bodies in the world, if they're shorn of desire for God, lead away from human flourishing and all that that means. The life that Christ comes to give comes to us as we experience the conversion of desire. A conversion of desire that comes as God's gift to us. Now, given that in the Gospels, the Samaritan woman is a good story, and Jesus speaks to us from that story about the possibility of his life reaching into places we may not have expected, and given that the parable of the Good Samaritan, kind of the paradigm of what it means to love our neighbors as ourselves, is going to come a few verses after the text we just read today, we might have expected that the Samaritans would come off well in this story, but they don't, do they? In fact, in this story, the outsider is portrayed as inhospitable, not welcoming to God or to Jesus. And inhospitality in the ancient world was an act of hate, not just of indifference, but of active, we don't like you, we're pushing you away. We live in a society where we have messed up, right? We're in this mashed up world. We have messed up understandings of tolerance on one side, and on the other, we have hateful racially charged ideas on the other. And it can make it difficult to say that the outsider can be hateful too. We can be hateful, but so can the outsider. And so Luke is nothing if not realistic about whomever he writes about, the insider disciples, the women who are following him, the crowds that Jesus addresses along the way of whatever ethnicity. And his disciples are sure that, of course, the right answer to this inhospitable act, that they won't welcome Jesus, is to call down fire from heaven. And we remember who has been calling down fire from our previous readings. It's been Elijah. Elijah, who has called down fire on the prophets of Baal. And now Jesus, acting as a prophet, they expect him to do the same thing. And so Jesus begins to show us that religion, even great religion or religious figures, can mess up God's desire. They too live in a mashed up reality, where they get it right sometimes and don't get it right other times. We can construct containers for religion or politics or economics or even in our families, in our work, in our leisure, that are not in cooperation with God's desire for us. So Jesus's refusal to act like a prophet, like even one of the greatest prophets, begins to crack open all of our cultural containers. by exposing our most fundamental way of acting in the world, which isn't so much freely chosen action as it is, what is it? It's reaction. Reactivity is our greatest problem, our greatest scourge. We know at one level, when we're thinking rationally or even intuitively, that to live non-reactively, the way Jesus does here, where he refuses to act out of hurt, where he refuses to wish the worst of people who have just mistreated him, is the only way to really live well. It is the way to live into human flourishing. It would transform our marriages. It would transform our relationships, our work, our leisure, indeed our very life's purpose. But try as we might, this is the thing that we struggle with. As cultures, we see that unfolding in Great Britain right now. We see it unfolding in the United States. It could happen here at any minute. We are drawn towards reactivity. The point of Jesus' amazing responses in our gospel to all that he encounters here at this table is that we can't overcome our reactivity without a profound conversion to a greater desire. It won't work by just appealing to law or duty. It is only this greater desire that will allow us not to negotiate with Jesus. Everyone who meets him in our text today is wanting to negotiate with him, but rather to begin to follow him, to follow his strange, challenging way in the world. As they stand, what Jesus asks of those who approach him in these small scenes is impossible. It's why we're initially quite hesitant to let this story into our hearts. Why it appears like that dicey uncle who shows up at the door. Jesus isn't your cheerful self-help teacher in this story today. It turns out we can't really follow Jesus, the story says, by adding a little bit of him on the side. We can't add him to home and hearth or to our business affairs. Rather, Jesus is daring to say here that if people really want to be his followers, if they desire to know him and to follow him, all that they hold dear will be redefined, reshaped, and changed. But not negatively. God, no, not negatively. The containers of our shallow existence will begin to be broken up towards desire, capital D, a desire for God's life. And this means everything will change for the better. All the disciplines that study human behavior are clear on this, as is the New Testament. Desire always wins. Always wins. It is far more powerful than reason or duty. In the mashed up realities that combine the beautiful and the marred, we are often confused about our deepest desires. Is it just to maintain the status quo? The sacred status quo? It doesn't get much more sacred in any culture than burying a parent, a father or a mother, an elder of our community. And yet Jesus challenges even that sacred status quo. What about the church's status quo? Is it simply our call to maintain Anglican parishes as if the last 50 years hasn't happened? Here's where it gets really interesting. We can't tell. We can't tell on principle. Rather, the good news of the gospel is that Christ is here, just as he was in those encounters, to sort our desires and to draw them to himself. This was the reason he framed the choices the way he did: home or Christ, sacred duty or Christ. And the third man that came to him, who wants to put his affairs in order, is probably something similar to saying living responsibly or Christ. It's not that Jesus imagined that we wouldn't bury our fathers or mothers, or have homes, or give a percentage of our income to the church and the poor. He certainly did, at least on principle. But by putting things in such stark terms, Jesus gives those who encounter him the gift of sordid desire and the invitation into a greater desire. See, I was determined. I had it all planned out in my 20s. I was going to live the single life with its privileges and responsibilities, and then I met Denise. Denise became more important than even important desires. And I rearranged my life around her. My little play on words is Denise always wins. The call of Christ comes then as a gift. Desire always wins. At some level, these stories aren't trying to twist anybody's arm in this room. They weren't trying to twist the arms of the men who approached him. They are opportunities to see our hearts. They are invitations for us to respond. But we must respond in integrity. If you're into negotiating with God, well, just continue to negotiate until your desires are sorted. Jesus will always tell you like it is, just as he shared with his original disciples and those who came up to him. But if his desire calls you, it will be as if when your uncle left the home and you go to open up your bank account and you realize that not only has he shared his life and his stories, he's deposited his life savings into your account. Our bishop, I'll just close with this, has understood that Christ's call is the key to renewed life in our diocese. She has asked all churches to recognize September 25th as Vocation Sunday. She wants us to expect God's call to ministry to be an active part of our communities. Whether that's vocations to the priesthood, to the diaconate, or just vocations to serve the kingdom of God in our lives, in our families, wherever we are. As our bishop puts it, Christ's call to follow him is sometimes direct, sometimes forceful, sometimes gentle, but always persuasive. Not from threat, but from a new heart, transformed desire, faith expressing itself by love. May it be so in all of our lives. Amen.